Good afternoon, council. You ready to proceed?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. In this case, the issue in Mr. Butcher's case was the identity of the person who sold cocaine to an undercover officer. Mr. Butcher was standing on the street corner with another individual, and the undercover officer pulled up and purchased cocaine. Mr. Butcher asserted that it was the other man standing there with him who had actually gone over to the car and sold the cocaine. And there was evidence from a couple of the police officers that there was, in fact, another man standing there on the corner. But the officers, of course, testified that it was Butcher who sold the cocaine. We filed a Flowers motion, and the court held an in-camera Flowers hearing and determined that the informant could not be helpful to the defense. In this appeal, we've asked the court to review the transcript of the Flowers hearing, which, of course, has been sealed, to determine if the correct procedure was followed. It's our position that the rule of evidence 509, which says that the testimony of the informant may be presented by affidavits, is actually deprives the defendant of his due process rights, and that in fact there should be a requirement that the informant appear personally and testify and answer the questions of the trial court in camera. And we have cited in our brief a couple of Third Circuit cases to that effect. And also in the Flowers case itself, the trial court did question the informant in person, in private, without the police officer being present. I do not know whether in Butcher the informant was present or not. But
is there any other allegation on your part of noncompliance with Rule 509 in this particular Flowers hearing?
Well, it's a little hard. It's very hard to say because we haven't seen the transcript of the hearing. I don't know what went on in the Flowers hearing, so that's difficult to say. I mean, we believe that, in general, that the informant should be required to be present, should be questioned by the trial court without the police officer present, so that the informant is...
Or anyone else?
Just the court reporter and the court. It's our position, because otherwise, if the prosecutor is there or the police officer is there, the informant could be intimidated in some way. Often the informants are people who have criminal records themselves.
Well, regardless of the policy to justify it, does Rule 509 on its face say that the Deputy Attorney General should not be there at the Flowers hearing?
It does not. But we believe not. I don't believe it does, Your Honor. But it's our position that
it should. Well, let me put it this way, more benignly. Does Rule 509 state who should be present at a Flowers hearing?
I believe it states...
If you're worried about intimidation, does the rule contemplate a Deputy Attorney General presenting evidence before the trial judge along with police officers or just the confidential informant?
I believe that Rule 409 does not specifically prohibit others from being there. And I'm looking at my argument here, but I don't have the actual text of Rule 509 in front of me. Under the present procedure, sometimes the informant is there, sometimes it's presented by affidavits, and it's my understanding the prosecutor is always there and the police officer is usually there.
Was there an affidavit in this case? Or do you know?
I don't know, Your Honor, because it's sealed.
On whom does the rule place the burden of showing that the confidential informant has evidence that would be material to the defense?
Well, the burden is on the defendant to file the motion and ask the court to examine the informant. So in that sense, the burden is on the defendant. But after that, the procedure is difficult for the defendant to address after that, because we don't know what went on in the Flowers hearing. We only know the ruling, which in this case is that the informant could not materially aid the defense. I mean, we believe there has to be some good faith belief on the defendant's side that this informant would help his defense. And in this case, Mr. Butcher asserted that because the informant was there and observed the transaction, that he could testify that the other man and not Mr. Butcher delivered the cocaine. We don't know. We're assuming that either the defendant or the informant said something different to the judge, or the informant was not there. We just don't know. But I think the burden is on the defendant to show that the informant could assist the prosecution.
Well, let's assume for a moment that Rule 509 wasn't complied with in every particular, regardless of the case law since Flowers. In what way does that demonstrate that your client was denied a fair trial?
Well, because if the hearing was not conducted correctly, then the results of the hearing may not be correct. And the results of the hearing, that the informant could not assist the defense, was extremely important to the defense, because if the informant could help the defense, obviously we would have called him or her, whoever, him in this case.
And your argument is if your client knew who the informant was or who was in the car, you would have called him as a witness to testify for the defense. But for purposes of this record, we have to assume the defendant didn't know and invoke the Flowers hearing procedure to find out and have the judge ascertain whether the confidential informant had a basis for identifying your client. Is that right?
That's correct. It's my practice. If my client tells me they know who the informant is, I don't file a Flowers motion. I don't know what other attorneys do, but sometimes the client does know who the informant is, and in that case, I don't file a motion. We just try to interview the informant if we can.
I'm confused. I thought you said a moment ago that your client did know who the informant was, or thought he knew who the informant was.
No, Your Honor. Mr. Butcher did not know who the – told me that he did not know who the informant was. There was a man standing on the corner with him, and Mr. Butcher says that when the police officer pulled up, that this other man and not he approached the car and sold the cocaine.
Well, it's the state's brief that suggests your client did know who the informant was. Is that brief incorrect?
Well, the police officer testified that the informant pointed out Mr. Butcher and said, "That's him standing over there on the corner." So I believe you could draw the conclusion.
Well, I thought the record showed that the sale had been prearranged by the informant, that whoever sold it didn't really know the policeman, but the policeman went to a prearranged spot that had ostensibly been prearranged by the informant.
Yes. So, I mean, one could draw the conclusion that if the informant knew Butcher, that Butcher must have known the informant. But all I can tell the court is Mr. Butcher told me he did not know the informant. If he had told me who the informant was, we would have tried to interview him.
How would you see a Flowers hearing work? Let's assume everything you say is true. The defendant doesn't know the informant. The defendant's trying to find out if a non-law enforcement person was present who could say he wasn't the seller. And the judge would call in the informant, and, you know, if the informant said, "Well, it was my first cousin, I've known him for 20 years, that would be the end of the inquiry. But suppose that he didn't know him, and then we had to either have a lineup, a photographic lineup or something like that. How would the hearing proceed absent some, you know, longstanding relationship that just ended the inquiry?
Well, I think that in that case, if the informant said, "I didn't know the man who came over to the car," I would say there would need to be a photo lineup.
So prior to that date, if that was the testimony, the judge would go back to the lawyers and say, I've interviewed the confidential informant who tells me the first time he ever saw the defendant or whoever made the sale was at the car window, and then the judge would take it from there.
Yes. Yes, I would assume so. Yes. And really thought it through to that stage. But, yes, I would say that if the informant couldn't say who sold the cocaine, there would need to be some further identification procedure.
Well, in this particular case, where there are two police officers who identified the defendant, wouldn't the CI, either by affidavit or in person before the trial judge, have to make the statement that suggested there's an inconsistency between the CI's identification and the police officer's identification before the CI would become material to the defense?
Yes. The informant, I believe, would have to say it was not Butcher who sold the cocaine, or I don't know who it was who sold the cocaine.
Or let's assume it's less dramatic. And he says, I really saw this person for the first time. I'm not sure I could identify him again, but I do know he's wearing a red jacket. And the judge conducting the Flowers hearing knows that the police officers have said the guy that made the sale was wearing a blue jacket. Would that create the kind of issue that would suggest the trial judge would have to conclude that the CI would be material to the defense?
Oh, yes.
But if the trial judge neither has an affidavit nor hears from the CI at all, on what basis does the trial judge conduct a Flowers hearing with any kind of burden shifting to either party to establish the materiality of the CI's potential information?
Well, I think that if the trial court does not have the informant and does not have an affidavit, then the trial court, the order should say, should inform the attorneys that he has no way to make a decision on whether or not he would be helpful to the defense. And then I think the next step would be that the defense would make a motion in limine of some kind to have that admissible into evidence, that this informant was not available to say who it was that sold the cocaine.
What, are you thinking about a charge to the jury that there's a potentially significant witness that the state has failed to call? And
yes,
they should
something along that line,
conclude,
yeah,
that if he were called, his testimony would be adverse to the state? Is that what you're saying?
Something along that line, yes, Your Honor.
How does that satisfy a burden? Are you suggesting to us then that the burden is actually on the state to establish that the CI's testimony is not material to the defense? The ultimate issue, as I see it, is what is the policy behind the Flowers hearing? Balancing the need to keep confidential informants in the drug business confidential, both for their own safety and for the purpose of getting helpful information for investigations in the future, versus the defendant's right of confrontation or the opportunity to acquire evidence that's uniquely within the possession or knowledge of the state but could conceivably be helpful to the defense. Add to that what we all know who've been in this biz, and that is that once you know that the state's going to disclose or have to disclose the name of the confidential informant, you've got at least a 50-50 likelihood the state's going to plead the case down or dismiss it rather than disclose their confidential informant. So that's one of the real reasons for the defense to want to pursue a Flowers hearing. So where does that leave us if we are ultimate people deciding what Rule 509 truly means in the implementation of a Flowers hearing?
Well, I think that what Rule 509 means is that the state has a right to keep their informant confidential, but the defendant has a right to find out if this person can help his defense. And the way that's done is by the in-camera Flowers hearing. Now, if the state cannot produce the informant, the defendant should certainly be entitled to the jury knowing that. I mean, and if the informant gives information helpful to defense, obviously obviously the defendant would want to know that. So the informant is a key person here because he's the one who allegedly set up this and then the person who was right in the car when it happened. So I think policy-wise, the state has a right to keep these people confidential, but only up to the point where it infringes on the defendant's right to due process. And if it interferes with the defendant's defense and ability to put on a defense, then that should outweigh the need for confidentiality.
Well, as Rule 509 is currently constituted, and as the case law interpreting a Flowers hearing to date has held, is that consistent with due process?
In our view, Your Honor, it is not. In our view, the informant should appear personally.
Okay. Do you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, Your Honor, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. I'll address the second issue in the briefing. That's the only issue that's been discussed so far, but if there are any questions about the first argument, I'll certainly attempt to answer those as well. Rule 509 of the Delaware Rules of Evidence does confer an evidentiary privilege upon the state to keep confidential the identity of people who have furnished information to law enforcement authorities. What was done here is kind of the normal process. That is, a pretrial motion is filed on behalf of the criminal defendant seeking to know or disclose, have the state disclose the identity and the whereabouts of a confidential informant. There was a confidential informant involved in this particular drug transaction. The confidential informant telephoned the accused prior to the transaction and arranged where this drug transfer would take place in the city of Dover. The confidential informant also accompanied the undercover police officer, who was a Delaware State trooper named Mr. Voschel, Officer Voschel, to the site. He rode along in the car as a passenger. When the transaction occurred on the afternoon of January 4, the confidential informant was in the car. Officer Voschel, the undercover officer, made a cocaine purchase from Mr. Butcher in this case. What was being sought by the defense was to suppress the both the out-of-court identification of Mr. Butcher as the seller as well as the subsequent in-court identification, and that relates really to the first issue. A photograph was shown to Officer Trooper Voschel approximately 45 minutes after the transfer.
I assume in this case, you've talked to the trial deputy about the Flowers hearing. Is that correct?
No, I have not. My experience has been that the prosecutors do not attend the Flowers hearing. I've never been to one.
And do you know yourself whether or not the confidential informant either appeared for the Flowers hearing or submitted an affidavit?
No, I do not know how it was handled. The Flowers hearings are usually done on a case-by-case basis by the trial judge and can unfold in a number of ways. Sometimes the confidential informant is, in fact, there. The investigating police officer will bring the confidential informant to the courthouse, and the trial judge will interview the confidential informant. Other times there are affidavits submitted, and the court simply examines the affidavits in camera. A third alternative is if the investigating police officer cannot locate the confidential informant, then the officer himself or herself may appear at the in-camera hearing.
And do you know of any situation where the confidential informant could be located and nevertheless there was not an affidavit and the confidential informant did not appear?
I don't know what the practices are. I mean, conceivably that could happen, but I would think if the confidential informant's available, that's the best evidence, and the officer would bring the confidential informant in, but that may not always happen.
Rather than focus on what the practices are, let's focus on what the practice should be, and then we'll look at what actually happened in this case. And let's begin with what, in your view, does Rule 509 require?
Well,
and then tell us whether you believe the requirements of Rule 509, if complied with, are satisfied due process.
Certainly. I think the starting point here is a U.S. Supreme Court case called McRae versus Illinois, and that says simply that a criminal defendant does not have a constitutional right to confront a police informant. But this privilege is not absolute, because the state also has an obligation under Brady versus Maryland to disclose information that's favorable to the defense. For example, if the state knows that the confidential informant was in the car and he told the police officer who views this photograph of Butcher later on that, no, that wasn't the person who sold you the drugs, you know, you're mistaken about that. The state has an affirmative obligation to disclose that, and that's regardless of whether there's a Flowers motion or not. That's an affirmative obligation the state has in every criminal case. So I think that's the background here. But how should the hearing be conducted? Well, I think it, in order to comport with due process here, I think you have to show what it is that the confidential informant does or does not know. And the trial judge has to make an assessment. Obviously, the best way would be a face-to-face questioning of the confidential informant if that individual's available and the trial judge can make appropriate factual determinations. Here, the trial judge did make a factual or factual legal finding.
Well, let me make sure that we don't skip over the language of Rule 509. Correct me if I'm wrong, but in doing what you've just described, the rule contemplates testimony be taken if the trial judge finds that the matter cannot be resolved satisfactorily upon affidavit. Does that mean that there must either be an affidavit, or if the affidavit is unsatisfactory, then testimony?
I think that would be the requirement, yes.
So is due process satisfied if neither are present?
If neither are present, I don't know that there would be any factual basis then. I mean, probably not.
Well, what does testimony mean? Does that mean testimony if the police officers alone would be sufficient, or does the rule contemplate testimony by the CI? Or does it simply contemplate whatever the trial judge hears, he or she can, at their discretion, determine whether or not the CI's testimony, never having heard from the CI by affidavit or by live testimony, but based solely upon the police officer's recollection of the facts, determine that there's nothing the CI could say that would be material to the defense. Is that contemplated both by the rule, and does it satisfy due process?
Well, I don't know if it's contemplated by the rule. I think it may satisfy due process in certain situations. The Hooks case, which I've attached as Exhibit D to the state's answer brief, in that case, the detective apparently alone testified at the in-camera Flowers hearing. There was a Detective Schiffler. In another case, I've attached Price, which is Exhibit H to the state's answering brief. In that in-camera review, there was simply a review of the state's affidavit. So I think given the rubric of the rule, the trial judge can certainly simply have affidavits submitted if the trial judge is not satisfied with those or thinks it's preferable to talk face-to-face with the confidential informant, then bring in the confidential informant.
Let me make sure I'm clear. So your view is that the rule, by using the language testimony and affidavit, can be simply limited to testimony or an affidavit from police officers. It doesn't contemplate an affidavit from the CI or testimony from the CI. The trial judge is free to conclude that the issue of materiality to the defense can be determined solely from the testimony of police officers.
Well, I think that was what was done in the Hooks case.
Well,
yes.
I understand that. And the Hooks case is in play, let's say, for the sake of argument. In your view, does that satisfy due process?
Well, I think it does, because the trial judge is still going to have to make credibility determinations. If for some reason he doesn't think the police officer's representation, if the police officer is the one who is appearing, is credible, then certainly he can delve further into it.
Suppose hypothetically the police officer said, I know it was Butcher. You're wasting your time to call in the confidential informant because I'm absolutely positive that's who I bought it from. Would that be enough?
Well, I think then it's just your normal question of credibility, and the trial judge in that situation is sitting as a trier of fact, and I think you have to leave it to the trial judge's discretion on a case-by-case basis if judge is satisfied.
Do we normally take comfort in credibility when it's presented solely by the advocate for one side and tested solely by the testimony of witnesses for one side?
Well, I think you have to focus on what the nature of the procedure is. And the procedure here is these are all pretrial in-camera hearings. This isn't the trial. And this is just an attempt by defense to learn the identity and whereabouts of the confidential
informant.
And what's
the role of the trial deputy attorney general at the Flowers hearing?
Well, they normally don't appear. I mean, I've never been to a Flowers hearing, and I think the rule, I was looking quickly at the rule, at the very end it talks about the sentence, says all counsel and parties are permitted to be present at every stage of the proceedings under the subdivision. This is subsection 509C. It says except a showing in camera at which no counsel or party shall have the right to be present. I don't think the practice is that the prosecutors are there.
Let's skip the practice, and let's assume hypothetically an advocate for one side is there, and there's no advocate for the other side present. Is that fatal to due process?
No, I don't think it's fatal. I think, again, it involves what the nature of the evidence is and whether the trial judge is or is not satisfied. Here, whatever happened, and the state doesn't know what happened at this in-camera hearing either, the trial judge was satisfied that the confidential informant could not materially aid the defense, and that's the standard
here. Well, let's assume hypothetically, Mr. Williams, that an advocate for one side does show up at the Flowers hearing. The trial judge is not directed to the rule that says no counsel appears at the in-camera hearing, and goes forward with the hearing as a result of a presentation made by counsel for one side in the absence of the counsel for the other side. Is the fact that it's contrary to the rule fatal?
Well, it may be. I mean, I think then it's a matter of what else happens, if anything. I mean, if it's only the attorney, then you're talking about hearsay and things like that the police officer is simply related a statement, and normally the police reporter, he may have talked to the prosecutor if the prosecutor is the one there. But I think what the Flowers hearing procedure is, and as it was laid out in the 73 Flowers decision, was that the confidential informant would actually appear. But at times that's simply can't be done because you can't locate the confidential informant.
So the best practice would be that the confidential informant actually appears and that the prosecutor is not at the hearing.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the best from all sides. It gives the trial judge the best evidence. Here is the person who's there. This is the individual that the defendant wants to learn about, his identity and his whereabouts. The trial judge can simply ask him pointed questions about what happened. The individual can recount whatever he recalls, and then the trial judge can make appropriate determinations.
Well, let me ask you about the other extreme, with no suggestion that this is anything other than hypothetical. At the scheduled in-camera Flowers hearing, a deputy attorney general appears with an affidavit from one or more police officers. And the affidavit or affidavit state, despite our best efforts, we cannot locate the confidential informant. But we were present at the time of the alleged buy, and we, each of us or one of us, states unequivocally that we recognize the defendant as the person who made the sale. Would that satisfy Rule 509, and correspondingly, would it also satisfy due process?
I think it would. I think the rule certainly talks about an affidavit practice, and if the police have made their best efforts to locate the confidential informant and they simply can't do so, frequently these people are also, the reason they know who can supply drugs is because they're drug purchasers themselves, and they're hard to locate sometimes. If the police can't find them, but they otherwise are firm in their identification as to who the seller was, that should be sufficient. But again, it's left to the trial judge's discretion to handle it.
Let's vary a little bit the hypothetical posed by the Chief Justice. Let's assume that the police submit the same affidavits as recited by the Chief Justice, but that the police, well, that if an affidavit had been submitted, that is, an affidavit of the CI had been submitted, the CI would have said, I'm not sure that the person who delivered the drugs was the defendant.
Well, I think if that's the information...
That is, had there been an affidavit by the CI, there would have been a conflict.
Certainly. Well, I think if there's
testimony of the people who were witnesses to the alleged crime.
Well, I think if that's the case, that's probably Brady material, and the state would have to unilaterally disclose that in any event, whether there was or wasn't a Flowers request.
Certainly, if the police know that that's what the CI would have said. But if the police don't know, then what?
Well, if the police don't know, then I guess we're another step removed into speculation, and speculation isn't sufficient here. The defendant has the burden of proof to show that the disclosure of the informant's identity would materially aid the defense. And in both Price and Hooks, this court said that, you know, that mere speculation in this regard is insufficient. So they've got to show something more than that.
How is the burden logically on the defendant when the defendant doesn't know who the CI is, doesn't know what the police are going to say either by affidavit at the Flowers hearing or by personal testimony at the Flowers hearing, and doesn't know that the Deputy Attorney General is at the Flowers hearing presenting the evidence and perhaps even making argument to the judge about whether or not the facts presented constitute evidence that would be material to the defense? How do you carry a burden when you're not there at the hearing where the burden is presumably being presented, or the facts are being presented that would allow one to conclude the nature of the burden?
Well,
or whether the burden's been satisfied.
I think the burden exists because we're talking about an evidentiary privilege, and this is simply an evidentiary privilege that's conferred upon the state or law enforcement agency.
I appreciate the fact of why the burden exists. How does the defense carry it under those circumstances?
Well, I think they're going to have to do something more than speculate, saying that we want to examine the transcript of the Flowers hearing to see if there's anything that might be helpful for the defense. That's just speculation, and that's what occurred here, and that's not enough. There's going to have to be something more concrete, and the trial judge has to be directed to what it is the defendant's disputing. If the defendant's saying, you know, I couldn't possibly have sold the drugs because I wasn't even in the state at that time, and that's the nature of the defense, well, you know, they're going to have to make some type of showing or further allegation like that to put the trial judge on notice to what the trial judge needs to be looking for or at least sensitive to in the Flowers hearing.
Well, what would they say, that since I was out of state at the time the state alleges that the sale took place, I can only reach one logical conclusion. The two police officers that say I was there were lying, and if there were a confidential informant there and he were to tell the truth, he would testify it's someone else who made the sale other than I. If that's in the defense affidavit, where do you go from there?
Well, then I think it's incumbent on the trial judge to go ahead and conduct the Flowers hearing, and preferably have the confidential informant there for a face-to-face examination and determine whether or not there's anything helpful that the confidential informant can provide. If the confidential...
Now, in this case, did the defendant do nothing more than say, my defense is alibi, therefore I want a Flowers hearing?
I think the assertion was that they wanted a Flowers hearing to determine if they wanted to know the identity and whereabouts. This was all pre-trial, so we didn't really know what the defense was. The defense as it unfolded at trial was, well, I was there, but it wasn't me that sold the drugs. It was the other individual who was standing on the street corner.
So the answer to my question is the defense didn't posit alibi or say that if anyone said I was there, they were lying. Therefore, we need the Flowers hearing to determine what the CI would do, either confirm what I say or confirm what the police say.
No, I don't think
it wasn't that detailed.
No, I don't think so, but I think that's usually the thrust of what the Flowers hearing is about, is that a person is asserting that it wasn't me, there must have been a misidentification or something like that, and we want to know if this confidential informant is going to confirm presumably the police identification of the individual, the suspect, as the seller or not, or if the confidential informant's going to contradict that. But as I said before, under Brady, if the state has any knowledge whatsoever that this confidential informant is going to contradict the identification by the police of or some third-party witness that the defendant is, in fact, the seller, the state has an affirmative obligation to provide that information to the defense anyway.
Does that include the name and address where the CI could be located?
Well, I think under Brady, you certainly have to furnish whatever information is favorable.
Well, wouldn't the state take the position that we would say that's what our confidential informant says, but we don't have to disclose the name of the confidential informant? Because the policy is that we need to protect our confidential informants.
Well, I haven't run into that situation before. I guess that's the collision between the state's responsibilities under Brady and the evidentiary rule. I think then when you're talking about constitutional rights, that Brady would have to prevail over any evidentiary privilege a state might have under Rule 509, that they're going to have to furnish the information if they know it's helpful or potentially helpful to the defense. And Brady is actually fairly expansive. I mean, it applies not only to the guilt or innocence, but if it's material, even to sentencing, the state has an affirmative obligation to supply the information.
But as a practical matter, if you're talking about a confidential informant, are the police going to have, question this confidential informant and say, oh, you know, we want to make sure that you're going to say the same thing that we've got to say, and because if you're not, we've got to hand over information to the defense about it. Confidential informant sets up the deal and then disappears. And the state isn't taking statements from a confidential informant and isn't, you know, using, if you will, that person for any other purpose. So how are they going to find out that they've got Brady material?
Well, they may not be able to in that circumstance if the CI generally has disappeared, and frequently they do. Here, though, the facts are that the confidential informant was in the car, was riding along with the undercover officer who made the purchase, and presumably if there's some, you know, discrepancy about who the seller is, I mean, the confidential informant arranged the transaction by calling Mr. Butcher and getting a time and place to make the transfer. Presumably, the confidential informant's going to speak up to the officer and say, you know, that's not Butcher. Or the other individual who's not involved in this is Butcher. I mean, this is some other intermediary who's actually doing the transfer. But there's no evidence that any of that occurred.
Well, confidential informants are still being used, aren't they, to get their charges reduced?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's...
So what's the incentive
reason
for the confidential informant to say, that's not the guy on the corner that I arranged to meet and sell the drugs, therefore I won't be entitled to have my charge reduced from trafficking to possession? How logical is that?
Well,
and how do we know whether that's occurring or not if the confidential informant neither gives an affidavit under oath, wow, to the extent we can trust it, the under oath affidavit, or doesn't show up at the Flowers hearing?
Well,
how does one test that?
Well, I think the circumstance is still that a drug transfer occurred, and then the only question is, have we properly identified who the defendant should be?
A rather important only question remaining, isn't
it? Oh, certainly, but that's, you know, we're talking about all this as a pretrial Flowers determination.
Do you agree that if the confidential informant is still around and can be found, at a minimum, the confidential informant should give an affidavit and the best practice is for the confidential informant to appear.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that was, you know, in Flowers, which kind of started all this, what Judge Quillen did in that case was actually have the confidential informant come in. And I think that's certainly the best practice for a trial judge to follow. You may as well go right to the source, find out what the person does or doesn't know. If there's something that the person can provide that's at all helpful to the defense, then fine. But, you know, the trial judge did conduct an in-camera hearing here and did make a determination, and it's the state's position that as long as that's based on competent evidence and it's not clearly erroneous, it should be upheld on appeal.
So the defendant's protection is the trial judge complying with the rule in 509 and the procedures in Flowers.
Yes, I think that's it, and I don't think there's any reason to adopt any other more rigid procedure that, you know, the police officer can never be present in the courtroom or anything like that. I think it's sufficient to leave it to the discretion of the trial judge, handle it on a case-by-case basis. And as has been indicated by the questions today, depending on what the facts are in the case, you know, a different type of inquiry may be mandated. And I think it's best left to the trial judge and best reviewed for an abuse of discretion by this court. If there's any additional questions, I'll attempt to answer those.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you.
The court asked about the practical effects of all of this, and in listening to Mr. Williams, I was thinking about Brady material. And, of course, the state has an obligation under Brady to disclose to the defense anything exculpatory or helpful to the defense that the state has. But very often, when the defense asks the prosecution, well, what about this or that? Isn't that Brady material? The answer is, well, we don't have that. We don't have that. I can't give you what I don't have. So applying that to this scenario, the state is not highly motivated to go out and try to find this informant and ask them more questions. In other words, this informant has done their job. They've set it up. They've done it. Somebody's sold cocaine. And the state would not be really highly, you know, motivated with all the police have to do to go out and find this informant and say, now, are you sure? Let me show you some pictures, and you be sure that that's the person who sold the cocaine. That's just not, in a practical sense, going to happen. And then when it comes time for the Flowers hearing, the police and the prosecutor may or may not make really strong efforts to find this informant. In regard to the court's earlier question about Rule 509, which requires testimony, it's our position that that means testimony from the informant. It just doesn't seem to make any sense that the whole Flowers process, the rule, would even be in existence if it would satisfy due process to have testimony only from the police officer.
The practical problem, though, is, isn't it, that the Flowers hearing is really an opportunity for an independent, objective magistrate to determine whether Brady material exists or not, in a sense.
Yes.
Whether or not the CI could offer anything that would materially aid the defense. And it's not, and it obviates simply a decision unilaterally by the prosecutor. When the rule uses the term testimony or affidavit, why wouldn't it include an affidavit from the police stating what they saw and the reason that they can't find the informant and put the informant in the presence of the court for the purpose of taking testimony? Because as a practical matter, a lot of the informants do leave, whether they, you know, leave with the good graces and a box of chocolates from the prosecutor or not, they nevertheless disappear from time to time. What else is the state to do other than to explain to the court the factual circumstance that make it impossible for them to bring the CI in to testify, and they bring the police officers, who in this case may have been present at the time, or any other case, to testify, and they have an affidavit or the testimony of the police officers, either one, explaining why the CI couldn't be there? Why isn't that enough?
Because the whole purpose of the Flowers hearing is to test the credibility of the police officer. The whole idea is to have this third person, this other person who was present, who's not a police officer, not the defendant, and he or she is going to say, I'm sure that was Butcher that sold that cocaine, or I'm not sure who it was, or it was a guy in a red jacket or a blue jacket.
Well, and let's talk practicality again on another point. Let's assume, hypothetically, that the Deputy Attorney General and two police officers who were present at the time of the buy are there at the Flowers hearing, and the CI in front of the judge, and with the three of them present, does testify his recollection. It's a practical matter. What are the odds he's going to testify any differently than what the police officers just testified to? Or are you suggesting that a true in-camera Flowers hearing would be one-on-one, the judge and the CI?
That is our position, that is the absolute best practice, and that the informant should be questioned by the trial court in camera without the presence of the police or the prosecutor, and that is what should be required, because otherwise it greatly increases the possibility that the informant may be currying the favor of the police and the state, who offered him some kind of a good deal for this, and it decreases the chances that he would actually tell the truth if he hasn't been telling the truth.
So, following up on the Chief Justice's question, if the confidential informant could not be located, you would expect the response to your Flowers motion to be, the confidential informant could not be located, not the confidential informant has nothing favorable to add.
Correct, Your Honor, yes. Because if the informant can't be located and can't be examined, then we cannot know whether he would or would not have anything helpful to say for the defense. So, yes, the response should be from the court just what it was, what the outcome was of the hearing. If the court has any other questions, I'd be glad to.
I hate to keep beating both sides up on this, but I'm trying to explore all the ramifications of this. Let's assume Justice Holland posited to you what's going to happen most often. Where do you go with what you mentioned earlier, your request at trial of the trial judge to have a missing witness instruction? How successful are you going to be on that? And you've done a lot of these cases, so what's your guess at the outcome? Your educated guess based on your experience.
Well, we might not be successful at the trial level, and then we'd be back here before Your Honors.
And you might not be successful here either, but let's put that aside. What's your educated best guess of what the trial judge will do when you make that request, based on the precedent from this court and Superior Court?
If, for example, the informant could not be located, informant can't be located. Well, I think that the trial court should give an instruction saying that a witness for the defense, that a witness who was, I don't know how it would be crafted, a potential witness for the state, a potential witness, period, with key information about this case could not be located, and that the jury should be allowed to make the assumption, should be allowed to infer that his or her testimony may have been helpful to the defense. In other words, I don't know what the court would do.
I may misunderstand our case law, but isn't it implicit in order to get that instruction that you establish that the party against whom you offer the instruction has that witness under their control, and all things being equal but for circumstances, they would ordinarily have called that witness? How do you satisfy that?
Well, I would argue that the state did have them under their control, and if they're a potential witness, should have kept them to some extent under their control. For example, the state always says to their witnesses, as we all do, you keep us informed of where you are. We might need you in this case.
Well, we may all be dogs chasing our respective tails, but you get back then to the policy that CIs are confidential. While the state may be able to use them for some purposes, the policy suggests the state's not required to to call them as witnesses under circumstances where they're not even required to disclose their names.
But there's the potential of a Flowers hearing, and so the state, in our view, should at a minimum say to this person, we need to know where you are, where we can reach you until this case is over, in case there is a Flowers hearing.
Okay.
So.
Audience. Thank you very much. We'll take the case under advisement.